receiving resources to be able to make films. Because even for me to be able to make the film, I was excluded from so many grant-making opportunities because of citizenship and residency requirements that so many of these opportunities require. So
Seth,
we're really
Hernandez,
grateful for all the people that have supported us.
I want to thank you for being with us and congratulate you on Unseen, which just premiered on POV. You can now watch it online. We're going to do part two at democracynow.org. Unseen. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Latino New Yorkers were 8 times more likely to be arrested for cannabis than white New Yorkers over the past 30 years. Black New Yorkers, 15 times more likely. White, black, or brown, data shows we all use cannabis at the same rate. Now New York has changed course and legalized cannabis for adults 21 and over. We are building an equitable industry that invests in communities. Learn more and visit cannabis.ny.gov.
And you're listening to radio station WUSB in Stony Brook. It's just about 6 o'clock, and that means it's time for another edition of Off the Wall. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you tonight, joined tonight by Kyle.
Hi.
Well, a lot to talk about tonight. Kyle, if you can stop rearranging the furniture. Okay, welcome.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, we had plenty of time to do that before.
WSB Stony Brook.
Yeah, I mentioned that. This is Off the Wall, and we're here for about an hour talking about the state of the world and what's been going on, things like that. It's springtime. A little too quick for my taste, but here it is, and I guess we got to deal with it.
And dealing with it, we are.
Yeah, warmest winter on record, I believe, and also the same thing in Canada. They say it's the warmest record in Canadian, warmest winter in Canadian history. So, yeah.
Happy spring.
It's going to be a hellstorm in summer. Just warning people that. If you have a warm winter and, you know, summer's already hot, what do you think's going to happen?
Yeah, this is a great time to do all the cleaning that you plan on doing and getting ready, maybe some remediation with insulating your home or otherwise. Ventilating, being prepared for warmer climates, and yeah, generally enjoying the sort of in-between season between extremes. Although I can't say that anymore because of exactly what you said. You know, this was not an extreme winter. It was a weekend winter.
Yes, it really was.
I think that was the phrase you...
I use many phrases, but pathetic is one word that comes to mind.
One of the
it was
ones
just,
you
it
were...
was, I mean, we had some snow, yeah, but it was like a weekend. That's
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Come on. Had snowshoes, had skis, had all kinds of things ready to go and just never got to use them.
That's not true.
It could have been true, and I'd be a lot angrier if I didn't make that investment.
Yeah, I'm not going to internalize what I did or didn't do as far as outdoor preparedness. It's not linked. What is linked is climate change.
If this planet changes everything, you know, even if all the idiots that are literally trying to kill the human race, even if they get out of the way, are we going to see another decent winter in our lifetimes?
Well, the way the seasonality could, I mean, depends on how permanent the changes are. I mean, there could be dips in the cycle, like in other words, a more extreme winter. Because that's part of the overall trend is more extreme weather events, but not in the lasting way. Like we perhaps
the temperature is definitely going up.
Reminisce about. Yeah.
Every forecast shows the temperature going up.
Right. And so zones that would have had longer seasons of colder weather, they might have more extreme weather, but for a different climate zone than they would have historically. Yeah.
You know, I was reading the paper today, just to get completely off to a different topic, and I read with sadness that Bill Jorgensen died. Now, of course, Kyle, you don't know who Bill Jorgensen is. I bet a lot of people listening don't know who Bill Jorgensen is, but for those of you who do, a sudden light has been turned on in the attic of your mind, and you're remembering Bill Jorgensen as that TV news anchor for Channel 5, back when it was not Fox, back when it was Metro Media, back when it was WNEW. And yeah, he was the newscaster, the inaugural anchor of New York's first 10 p.m. news broadcast, the very first one. He died at the age of 96. Honestly, I thought he had already passed, but that happens a lot, actually. But 96, you know, pretty good life there. Jorgensen actually retired from TV decades ago. He was a key figure in what was then a brand new idea, the 10 p.m. news, on a so-called independent station that was unaffiliated with one of the three major networks. Channel 5, as I mentioned, was WNEW, the flagship station of Metro Media. And Metro Media emerged from the ashes of the defunct Dumont TV network back in the 1950s. That station was owned by John Kluge, at one time the richest man in the United States, who had no inclination to pay by the established rules set by the major networks, in part because he knew he had to draw audiences away from their popular 10 p.m. shows. This article, by the way, coming from Bern Gay over at Newsday, and it sums up so much, which is why I'm quoting it extensively here. Enter the 10 o'clock news with this memorable tagline that's still used today and probably all over the country now. It's 10 p.m. Do you know where your children are? Have you ever heard that phrase, Kyle, out in Seattle? Do they say that?
No.
Well, they probably say it's 7 p.m. Do you know where your children are?
Right.
Because everything is earlier there. Self-described guerrilla news operation that hounded public officials on the streets, covered robberies, shootouts, and civic mayhem with all kinds of enthusiasm that the standard stations didn't have. You know, the what they call the owned and operated stations, stations owned by CBS, NBC, ABC in New York City. They were owned and operated stations. Now, back in March of 1967, that's when the 10 o'clock news launched. Bill Jorgensen was from Cleveland, and it was described as one of the producers as the most intense local news operation in history. It was an in-your-face, hard-driving newscast, and the staff included anchors who would go on to succeed Jorgensen, such as Bill McCrary and John Rowland, as well as commentators Dr. Martin Abend, Roland Evans, and Robert Novak, as well as Dr. Joyce Brothers, Rona Barrett, and Stuart Klein. I haven't heard these names in years. They covered both sports and Broadway openings. And they used to have a promotional ad that was headlined, "The News is No Laughing Matter," which included a tight headshot of a scowling Bill Jorgensen. I'm going to show you a picture of this guy. This guy was the face of authority. I wish I could do it over the radio, but when you see that face, you know this is serious. No clowning around here. Now, Jorgensen was described as a voice of God presenter who signed off each broadcast. And I remember this now. This is the first time I've thought of this phrase in decades. Every broadcast, he would sign off by saying, "This is Bill Jorgensen, thanking you for your time this time until next time." Huh?
Catchy.
Can you say that? I can't say that without looking at a piece of paper. But he said it every night. "Thanking you for your time this time until next time." That was my childhood. That was something I remember hearing late at night, every night.
"Thanking you for your time this time until next time."
Good, but your voice sounds way too pleasant. And, you know, he sounds stern, you know, foreboding, commanding.
"Thanking you for your time this time until next time."
Sound like you don't have control of the situation. You see, it's...
I don't...
Well, I'm just saying, it takes time. He didn't do this overnight. It took years of training. But I want to share with you some other things that was special about Bill Jorgensen. He had it written into his contract that he was the only one who could use a teleprompter. Yeah, the only one who could use a teleprompter on set. Now, what this meant was when he was debriefing a reporter, you know, on set, when he was asking them questions about a story they had just reported.
Yes.
The reporter would have to constantly look at his notes. But by contract, Jorgensen would always look steadily into the camera, which projected an air of power and confidence. The story added, he was feared by some, despised by others. Beloved is a word rarely ascribed to him. Now, this is honesty right here. This is the kind of thing that... that you treasure, you prize. This was a moment in history. Now, Kyle, I know I've seen you watching Seattle television, which we're able to receive, fortunately. And sometimes there's something about a newscaster that you grew up with that tugs at the heartstrings. Either somebody passed away or somebody retired, or are there names you can remember from various stations out there and why they were significant?
Well, yeah, like Dan Rather.
Dan Rather?
No, I'm thinking specifically, recently we just lost Steve Poole, who was a weatherman.
You know, I'd never heard of, because why would I hear about Steve Poole in Seattle? But I saw a retrospective. What station was he on? King or?
Well, he had, like many people in local TV and that business in general throughout his career, been to a variety of stations, but spent a large amount of his career at KOMO. Kathy Gertzen,
KOMO. Okay.
Yeah. There's a pretty good number of local TV personalities and even producers that I got to know and I'm familiar with. But that was a big one because he did a lot of outreach. And when I was in elementary school, I was on his circuit of schools that he would visit. Like he was very big into like teaching and outreach and part of the community, like someone that everybody recognized. And I think it was a voice of authority, right? Like when you're a student and that's the person that's telling you and your parents, you know, everybody listens to Steve. So, right. It was a big loss.
Now, he was a guy that would just kind of ingratiate himself into whatever set was in the area. And I remember people would whenever they were bringing something to the station, whenever there was like a cooking demonstration, he would always suddenly just appear in the background. He would always be a part of that somehow.
Yeah, that was something that was pretty cool. Joyce Taylor, I think, was a part of some of those shows. And there were other personalities that basically would be a part of the local programming, and they would have like a restaurateur or some kind of food oriented feature during their show, and he would just somehow appear and be a part of sampling or trying whatever was there. And that was something that I didn't know about him necessarily, but it tracked sort of but that's the benefit of, I think, someone that spent so much time in a place like that recording and being on television and around so many people. So it was a part of the collage in that retrospective.
Yeah. You know, it's easy to dismiss and say, it's just, you know, TV personalities, but it can mean something, especially if done right. It can speak to people. It can inspire people. It can comfort people, get them through difficult stories, difficult days. And, you know, it's something that we have in common. You can talk to people in Seattle and they will know who Steve Poole is, and they will share stories about growing up with him on the TV set. Just like I'm sure there are people out there who remember Bill Jorgensen and, you know, can share stories. I'm remembering now all kinds of newscasts or just stories that I remember as a kid from just that one newscast. And of course there were others in the area as well. But
it's cool because like Joyce Taylor specifically had an early like a morning show or on Cairo, I think.
KIRO.
But or I think there were some other early shows that no one would remember. And I think that's
People who remember. That's the thing. There's always somebody who remembers.
Right. Right. And like if you were, you know, watching TV at that point, and when I guess it was like one of my first memories of new programming or something changing and recognizing hosts moving around in some of those roles. That's why stuff like that sticks with me, because like we're pointing out, you then look back at an entire career and you realize this person was just there doing
right
and moving around to maximize their ability to just excel in whatever they're passionate about.
You know, people feel the same way about hosts on the radio here at WUSB. They're voices that we've grown accustomed to.
Oh yeah.
And we see the world through their voices, and it's the magic of broadcasting, radio and television. But I remember it was a year or two ago when we were at a presentation that our good friend Mike Uhouse was giving here on Long Island about trains. And we wound up talking to some people there, and there was a guy who actually was one of our listeners who knew everything about a TV station called WSNL, which was Channel 67 in Smithtown. And I remember that like it was yesterday. I remember being a kid, waking up first thing in the morning, because I used to do that. I think it was on a weekend, and just watching this TV station sign on the air for the very first time. And it was a particularly special moment, because somehow I had a program guide, which I think was included in the Sunday paper. So I had this glossy color schedule, and I knew when all the programs were going to be on. And boy, did they have a lot of local programming. Everything was produced. There were children's shows. There was a, I don't know how I'm remembering this, but there was a soap opera, a Long Island soap opera. I think it was called The Fairchilds. And just all of these memories came pouring back, and little things that you just store away in your mind. We shouldn't dismiss that. We should, you know, celebrate that, share it, and tell it to other people as well, because guaranteed, you know, with media, there are those little nuggets that you can extract and get something out of, whether it's a person, whether it's a program, whether it's a broadcast entity. I mean, why do you think we're involved in radio? It's because something inspired us to walk through the door and say, hey, I want to do this. I want to try something.
Yeah, I got a really like unique vantage. There's a lot of good stations there, and all of them have different stories and are struggling in different ways as the market and the industry changes. And some of them have ways you can get involved and learn about them. I know a lot of the community stations out there mm-hmm. are similarly modeled to a college station like WUSB. And yeah, I mean, I recently messed around with one of the apps for one of them, I think KING, and they have huge archives there.
They do, yes.
And it reminds me of all the stuff we have at this station that I think would be great to have in an accessible way mm-hmm. so that people can learn about the history and have a hands-on perspective and appreciate just how much has been captured. And it's really about storytelling. And that's something that professionals and people that really dedicate their lives in local market stations like that, they really want to just sort of do the best work they can. And there is something, I think, to be taken from that in how so much of what they do we can replicate because the means of production have become affordable and we're all sort of producers. We can make media, we can make visual stories as well as radio and other kinds of news gathering, as well as just longer form stuff that engages. And they can, I think, guide that. Like some of the stuff we've looked at that's like transit related and in stories like that, it is really well done. Some isn't as good, but there's some pretty really like detailed and competent how-tos and instructionals and stuff like that. So like I guess the same can be done with people that are doing like spot news or community news at a college station. Sure. Like they're the example that you can really like try to polish your own work.
There are so many parallels too.
It makes me want to do better stuff.
Yeah. To what your parents or grandparents would listen to on the radio, right. To what people are doing right now on YouTube or various other places. There is that same desire to share and to inspire and to hear back from people as well.
And it might come off as stern, you know.
Well, but yeah, that's, Bill Jorgensen, he was stern. He was definitely, but you need it stern.
But
Cronkite was stern as well. Huntley Brinker, they were stern.
That's your anchor. Mm-hmm. So find your anchor.
Wolf Blitzer. Well, he's not so stern, but yeah, okay. So sternness helped. Hey, but on the subject of archives and lost audio and things like that,
yeah.
It made me realize, you know, a couple of years ago we did the Lost Audio Project,
uh-huh.
where every day for a couple of months we released new audio. Or audio that had just been found, and much of it is WUSB. And you can go through that again. I just found it myself because I forgot where we put it. If you go to our website at 2600.com and click on Features, or maybe hover on Features, the first choice is Lost Audio. And if you click on that, you'll see a whole list of dates where we would release one audio piece after another. They could be interviews, they could be air checks, they could be all sorts of things. And it's a lot of fun. And some of it, you know, there in there somewhere is my very first recollection of WUSB, where I turned on the radio at my house when I lived in Stony Brook, and I heard this new radio station, and I heard this voice saying, this is a test broadcast. that voice being that of our good friend Frank Burgert, our chief engineer, to this day. And of course, I didn't know him then. And that was, I believe, 1977. And just, it's incredible to realize, hey, there's the voice of a good friend of mine before I knew who he was at all, captured, you know, through the magic of tape and broadcasting. So it's really incredible. Please share your stories, your memories. Write to us, otw@2600.com. We'd love to hear from you. On the note of things that are local and valuable, this story has been spreading around in the area. To the east of us is a town called Port Jefferson, or a village called Port Jefferson. Some of the residents there are advocating the defunding and closing of the school district. Yeah, it's really hard to imagine. And I want to read a little bit of an opinion piece that was published in the Port Times, which is the local newspaper there. Talking about these people, this is from someone named Phil Griffith. They promise an illusionary tax reduction. I believe the schools and students are our village's greatest assets. Since the first school opened in 1820, Port Jefferson residents have enthusiastically supported educating our children. It's time to rebuke those who would abandon that tradition. The human cost of closing the schools would be devastating. Students would be transferred to presently unknown school districts. All employees would lose their jobs, salaries, contractual rights, and benefits. Local control by our elected school board would be lost. Residents will not be permitted to vote on school budgets or elect Board of Education members. Parents and students lose proximity to schools. Businesses will discover lower takings because students, parents, and special events attendees will shop elsewhere. We'll no longer be able to brag about the super schools in our village. No longer will prospective home buyers choose Port Jefferson because of the prestigious reputation of our educational system. And how will that affect home prices? If you want to go down that route, of course. Now, this editorial raises, or this opinion piece raises many, many good points. Now, Port Jefferson has a very low ratio for teachers to students. I believe it's 1 to 11. Like for every 11 students, there is one teacher. Now, as is the case in many parts of the region, attendance is going down, population is going down. And that has led some to say, well, you know what, our taxes can go down too if we simply don't have this this drain on our budget called the school system. And, you know, I just, it really makes me wonder how we get so jaded. You know, how we can look at something as precious as local schools and see that as a burden, see that as something that we can do without. We can just simply, you know, make everybody go somewhere else and not worry about it. And, you know, I remember my days going to local schools and how much better it was than going to someplace that was further away. You know, I think the village of Port Jefferson, whenever school lets out, all the kids go through town. They all walk down Main Street. And it's, you know, a little bit of mayhem, a little bit of noise, but it's a very important part of life, is being in a community, being in a village, recognizing people, you know, going to stores. All of that is lost if you send kids far away. Yeah, they go back and forth by bus, and that's it. We have to have a better outlook on the things that matter. And I don't think anything matters more than schools, because that is where you basically get it all. You know, you get all the inspiration, all the education. You meet people, you know, you learn to interact. And if you're lucky enough to have a school next to a village, wow. It doesn't get much better than that. So I sure hope Port Jefferson comes to its senses. And you know, if you have to spend a few extra bucks to keep the buildings open, it's worth it. But I think it's not even that. I think they already have lower taxes than many other places. They just want more. Again, I don't think this is the majority. I think this is just some jaded people that, you know, want to pay as little as possible, participate as little as possible. You know, society doesn't work that way. It can't work that way. And I sure hope that we steer this bus in a different direction than where we're going. You know, we have so many people representing us at the local level who are so filled with hate and nastiness that, you know, I've never seen before at that level. Case in point, the New York State Assembly, we used to have Steve Englebright representing us. And for the many years that he represented us in Albany, he basically brought people together. Talk about the environment, talk about education, talk about all kinds of things. And sure, there were arguments, there were disagreements in Albany, but that didn't really become part of who he was. And then this red wave came one year, and he was replaced for no good reason other than the fact that he wasn't a Republican. He had done a great job for many, many years, but now we got this guy named Ed Flood. And what Ed Flood does is he brings all the ugliness from Albany and spreads it around, just like Nick LaLota, our congressional representative, just like Lee Zeldin before him. So it becomes all this pro-Trump nonsense, hatred, resentment. The illegal aliens are everywhere. The people, everyone's out on with no bail, and there's criminals, and it's dangerous, and you've got to, you know, get rid of these people in Albany, and Kathy Hochul is the devil. Never before have we had that kind of dialogue on a local basis from an elected official, and yet here we are. It's becoming normal, you know, everywhere you look. And what do we gain from it? We gain absolutely nothing. We lose so much. We lose everything that we value because we're at each other's throats. We don't listen to each other. We don't see advancement. I'm happy to say Steve Englebright is back on the county legislature. So, and that's you know, where he was before he was on the state assembly. But boy, it's a real shame that he got kicked out of the state assembly just because he wasn't a Republican. That had nothing to do with his record. And that was duplicated all around this area. And it really makes me ashamed that New York, of all places, is bowing into this this ugliness that is infecting our entire country. And that, in fact, we are front and center. The reason why the House of Representatives is in the hands of people who don't want to accomplish anything and who will sooner torpedo a decent deal. I'm referring to the recent border deal, just because their commander, Donald Trump, says, make sure this doesn't pass. Such ugliness. And now, you know, what's crazy is that depending on where you read the story, the magnitude might not be emphasized as much as it should be. But basically, the Republican National Committee, the RNC, is now the Trump reelection committee as well. They are the same. Trump has taken over the RNC. They have merged. There is no difference. And that's not normal. That's not supposed to happen like that. Yeah, they back the candidate. Sure, that happens. But being one and the same? No. No. Especially when the candidate is trying desperately to raise money to keep himself out of prison and from having to sell his real estate. God forbid. It becomes more about a person and much less about government. Now, we don't have nearly enough time to go through this, but Kyle, you heard the what's known as the bloodbath controversy, right? That happened this week?
Yeah, it was during something about auto automakers and unions and what he would do. And it's just this slow trickle of what did he say today, what did he say today. And this time he said if it didn't go his way, there would be a bloodbath, and tried to walk it back as like, okay, this was just like an economic thing he was talking about. But the fact is he diverges constantly when he's doing his little mouth diarrhea thing. So it just goes all over the place. So should be forgiven for letting their minds wander, you know, to what he might mean by bloodbath, because I mean, bloodbath is bloodbath.
Look,
right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, okay. It's been used, as, a metaphor. Is that the right word?
Yeah. Like the leader of this Senate majority leader used it when talking about the midterms, for instance.
Yeah. And, but here's the thing. Okay. Yeah, sure. You could say the Mets are playing tonight. It's going to be a bloodbath. Yeah. We're used to that. But this played out differently. And if you understand the language, I'm an English major, so I know a little bit about English. I don't often say things like that, but I'm just so upset at seeing how this is being twisted. So when this guy used the bloodbath word, instantly on social media, or within the next few minutes, one of his people made great pains to refer to what I believe was economic bloodbath. Like they were basically already doing damage control, saying, that's a thing, that's a phrase. See, here it is, right there. I said it, and it's on Twitter. But that's not what he said. That's not how he said it. Okay, they're claiming it's being taken out of context. Well, then let's look at it in context. Let's look at what he said without just stopping at the bloodbath part, and see how that sentence played out. All right. He's talking about automobile manufacturing. All right. That's clear. And then he says this: now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole, and then he interrupts himself. That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it. He repeats. Now, when you say something like it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole, and then interrupt yourself and say that's going to be the least of it, you're basically categorizing what you're saying as not the important part of the statement. So you were talking about cars, yeah. At the beginning of this sentence, you were. If I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath. But you know what? No, that's not important. That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath. For the auto industry? No, for the country. He said it right there. He made it clear. He clarified. Doesn't happen often, but Trump clarified. And he said, it's going to be a bloodbath for the country. Now, you could say, okay, but it's going to be a metaphorical bloodbath. It's not going to be real blood. Well, here's the thing. If we were to go over to, say, Ukraine, where there's a war going on, and we say, oh boy, here come some Russian troops, going to be a bloodbath, it's likely that that will be a real bloodbath with real blood, not a metaphorical bloodbath, because there's actual blood being spilled. In this case, where we're talking about a contentious election where everybody is afraid of violence, everybody on all sides is saying this is going to erupt in violence. This is very likely. This could happen. And the signs are becoming more and more certain that this will occur at some point. Well, when you have that kind of a scenario and you use the term bloodbath, it stops being metaphorical and starts being literal. So, you know, you can't say that Trump is not aware of this. Of course he is. He's at the center of it. So for him to say, you know, this will be a bloodbath for the entire country, I think that means quite clearly a violent bloodbath with actual blood for the country if he does not get elected. And it doesn't have anything to do with cars, not the auto industry. Yeah, it started that way. That's what he was talking about. But he has a tendency of of veering away from what he's talking about and saying what's actually on his mind. So no, this is not being misinterpreted. It's being interpreted exactly as it was meant. And those people trying to convince you otherwise, watch out for them, because they're buying into this crap, and it's dangerous. It's super dangerous.
Yeah, even if it was like expounding on other sectors of the economy, you wouldn't say the whole country, because the whole country isn't just economic, just an economic phenomena.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if I say
it's like a whole populace is
the
really,
Mets are going to lose in the bloodbath, you know, the whole country. Well, you know, that wouldn't make any sense. Why would I say the whole country unless I meant this is bigger than a baseball game? This is, you know, this is going to spill out into the streets. And this is what his people say constantly, that the only way he can lose is if the other side cheats. And if that happens, we've got the Second Amendment, you know, all kinds of overt and covert threats. So, yeah, we know what this is.
Yeah, and the part about it that is a little kind of spooky to me is the sort of mass hypnosis of it, that like the repeating of this phrase constantly. And I think it's people are looking for permission because they've been hearing this. And I think in a moment like an election, if there's, I mean, the same thing happened with the transfer of power on January 6th, the ways people were reacting amplified the ways others reacted, and that is how a riot or a mob, whatever you want to call it, that's how it reacts. I mean, even like a concert, you know, people play off that energy. So saying this to yourself when you start seeing things that are anomalous, it is short-circuiting, I think, some logic where you'd say, oh, that's anomalous. And instead, it's I think, setting up a sort of confirmation bias, like in people that should otherwise be thinking a little bit more critically.
Yeah. You know, and I'm just going through various things. I didn't have time to go through everything he said this week. But I'm looking.
And you shouldn't. I mean, that's the problem. But everybody's trying.
No, but you have to, Kyle. You have to pay attention. You know, and it's ugly, and it really gets you upset. But
okay, know. I know, but I can still recognize if you have to. That's okay. The initiative is there. People are covering it. We are hearing every single day what he's saying. But realize, like, that's the flow of information is. Exactly, because he knows the kind of reporting that is being done in earnest and is abusing that coverage with crazy crap every day now.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe, or, you know, early it's like, oh, where is he? We need to listen. Oh, I don't listen to truth, you know, so somebody please tell me what was said in, you know, in summary. But it's. Now it's just sort of an echo chamber, and I hope we recognize that.
So anyway, he's basically saying that migrants are not people. Yeah, in some cases they're not people, in my opinion. Okay, today, or was it yesterday? I don't know. He basically said this: any Jewish person that votes for Democrats hates their religion. They hate everything about Israel. They should be ashamed of themselves because Israel will be destroyed. Utter nonsense. Utter garbage. And very insulting, very patronizing. But interesting story. You heard what Chuck Schumer said last week about Netanyahu. It's you know, we've been saying this for months, literally. Netanyahu is the problem. What he is doing is so incredibly wrong, so incredibly harmful, and it was on his watch that October 7th happened in the first place, where all kinds of signals were missed. And yeah, it is time for the Israeli people to choose. And, you know, that is what Chuck Schumer said. someone who's Jewish himself. He gets it. Took a while, but he got it. And he said it. He said it out loud. And boy, Netanyahu is pissed off.
Oh, yeah. Big man.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Can't say that he rushed to call him out, but it definitely was said in no uncertain terms.
Now, he was on, of course, Fox News, and he said, "We're not a banana republic. The people of Israel will choose when they will have elections and who they'll elect. And it's not something that will be forced on us." Well, that's what Chuck Schumer was saying. It's time for new elections. And in those elections, the people will choose. You're the one standing in the way of new elections. The people don't want you, and you know that.
That was the case prior to October 7th.
Do you remember all the demonstrations against Netanyahu before that? And, it's hard to do that now when the nation's at war. And he knows that. He knows that. As long as the nation is at war, he can stay in power.
Knows
it's,
that.
It's disgusting.
Knows that. How about loves that?
And the barbarism that he is unleashing upon innocent people, it's so disgusting. And, yeah, it's time for elections. It's time for democracy to speak. And he's the one complaining now, saying that we have no right to say this. We have no right to tell them what to do. Well, you know, nobody's telling anyone what to do. People are expressing opinions that don't line up with your narrative. And, just while we're on the subject, though, was it you, Netanyahu, who embraced Trump back in the day? Mitt Romney in 2012, I believe, you pretty much all but endorsed him. To say that Netanyahu has not had influence in American elections is completely ignoring what's right there in front of you. So, I'm glad to see this come to the forefront. I'm glad to see the United States actually standing up to this bullying, because that's what it is. It's bullying, and it's disgusting, and it needs to stop. And, you know, the future needs to be figured out with cool, sane heads. And this kind of thing can never happen again. Yeah, so that's something. That's a big development, and I'm very curious where it goes. And you know, I gotta say, I'm impressed with Biden to a degree. You know, I like many others, I was cringing at all the blind support saying Israel has the right to defend itself as they're destroying apartment buildings and killing tens of thousands of civilians. Not really what defending yourself is all about. And if you dare say Palestinians have the right to defend themselves, that makes you a terrorist. That makes you anti-Semitic. No. We're not that stupid. All right? And of course, there are a lot of stupid people. There are people who can't bring themselves to condemn Hamas, to say that this organization is terrible and it needs to go. Why is it so hard to say both? I don't get that. But it is true. It is true. There are relatively few people that can do that. We only have a few minutes left, but I did want to... I just saw this story, too. The federal judge down in Florida, the one who works for Trump. Make no mistake. Eileen Cannon, the U.S. District Judge, is on Trump's payroll, might as well be, because every ruling she makes in the Mar-a-Lago case of, the secret files has been either bizarre or completely in his favor for absolutely no reason. It's a disgrace. This person should not be in charge of this case. Somebody who is appointed by the person who's being held up to scrutiny? No. This is so wrong. Anyway, the gentle here in the Daily Beast, the MAGA-friendly federal judge who keeps siding with Donald Trump in his Mar-a-Lago classified records case has forced prosecutors to make a stark choice. And this is bizarre. get ready, allowed jurors to see a huge trove of national secrets or drop the case. So that's her choice. Came last night. Ultimatum. Surprise twist. And what could have been a simple order, one merely asking federal prosecutors and Trump's lawyers for proposed jury instructions at the upcoming trial. But as she has done repeatedly, Cannon used this otherwise innocuous legal step as yet another way to swing the case wildly in favor of the man who appointed her while he was president. So Department of Justice Special Counsel Jack Smith must now choose whether to allow jurors at the upcoming criminal trial to peruse the many classified records found at the former president's South Florida mansion, or give jurors instructions that would effectively order them to acquit him. This is disgusting. This is absolutely awful. And when you combine it with all the shenanigans going around with the other cases against Trump, where the prosecutor and DA were maligned in Georgia for something that I still don't see where the scandal was, having a relationship between people who are on the same side anyway, in the same office, doesn't make any sense to me. But they made it an issue that could derail that case. All the other postponements and delays and getting the Supreme Court involved, the Supreme Court, most of which also works for Trump, we could very well see all of this, all these legal efforts against the corruption, against the cheating, against the lying, against all of the evil that has been unleashed in the past few years. We could see all of that crumble because of the corruption of the system. Yeah. And then, you know, you have to wonder what the reaction will be to that. Either this country completely falls apart or it completely goes up in flames.
No. We haven't even gotten started. It's I think, long past time to, I think, not respond to this. And I think one way or another, people will seek and find justice. These courts and stuff, they can't leave things the way they are attempting to. And it's really hard to talk about. And I think people don't really have an interest in talk anymore. It's about acting and being a part of the oversight and the sort of change that needs to occur.
Look, I want to agree with you. I do. I think
I'm trying to be upbeat.
I think we're very, you're not sounding very upbeat, but you know, I think there's plenty of evidence to show that the courts can be corrupted and that we are in very grave danger of having that happen. And if that happens on this level, so many people are going to give up on the system entirely.
That's what I'm trying to avoid saying.
But I think it is up to the people to remain involved and paying attention and getting outraged when something like this happens, where cases are thrown out that have so much merit, so much evidence, you know, from independent sources, and to simply use your power and corruption to get rid of all that. That's you're in a totalitarian regime at that point.
Well, what about our power in response? I think like
that's the power of the individual.
We're on top of this. We're coming for this, whether it's, you know, adjudicated properly or not. It'll be appealed. It'll be recognized. I mean, there's a lot of people that are disagreeing with how this is going down.
And I really want to just
mark my words. We are.
This story, though, is what I wanted to focus on. Unfortunately, I only have a couple of minutes. Next, Benedict, the trans student from Oklahoma, who died after a fight in a bathroom. It turned out the death was a suicide. And, you know, President Biden, he tweeted about this, saying this is horrible and that we need to support people, not make them feel endangered, not accept bullying. And the response to that was disgusting, absolutely disgusting. From all these people, who basically said, how is being trans helping your mental health now? You know, just all kinds of basically blaming the whole, I don't know what they think it is, the trans movement for making kids kill themselves, or basically somehow comparing this to the woman, Laken Riley, who has been politicized because she was killed by somebody who was in this country without documentation, as if condemning one makes you accept the other. You know, basically saying, say her name, not this other person's name, because for some reason this case means more. It's disgusting. It is disgusting how people react to this. And that is the vast majority of comments that I saw on pretty much all the stories I read about this.
We have got to look at what our problem with others is. It's not the people that are killing themselves that are the issue. And to say that is a hallmark. I mean, it is absolutely a part of going through that, and it is not from being oneself, right? It's not an innate part of those individuals' identity, but it is a part of the way society reacts, responds, treats, and accommodates people like this. It's so sad. It's so common. And you hear about it early on, you don't fully understand it until you've seen a couple of these stories, you've lived it perhaps. All of that really does matter. It's so tragic.
It's very tragic. Unfortunately, real tragedy is we don't have time to talk about it. Next week, definitely, we should spend more time on this, because it just is indicative of how ugly this society has become, where this kind of thing is politicized, whether it's somebody who's killed by somebody from a particular place, as if that has anything to do with it, or somebody whose sexual identity is different than yours. It's something we really have to study. We have to do some insights and it's, looking at ourselves.
It's almost like society wants ugly.
It almost seems that way for the ratings. OTW@2600.com is our email address. It's been Off the Wall.
See ya.
Stay tuned to USB. We'll see you next week. Good night.